Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for this channel. Today, we're talking with Phoebe Chow about her study of Britain's relationship with China in the early 20th century, entitled Britain's Imperial Retreat from China, 1900 to 1931. Phoebe, welcome to the show.
Hi, Mark. Thanks.
I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Yeah, sure. So I'm based in London, but as you can tell from my accent, I'm not British. I actually grew up in the States, so I'm Chinese American, but I've always been interested in British history. I came across this topic somewhat in a roundabout way. I was doing a master's in history and I was fulfilling a language requirement in Moscow. So I was studying Russian at that time, but I took a side trip to London where I met some of my friends who were studying at the London School of Economics and Political Science, and they were in the history department. I told them I was interested in doing a PhD, and they recommended that I get in touch with Anthony Best, who was a specialist in international history, but kind of in actually Japanese and British relations, but he was interested in the region in general. So I went back to Russia, found his book in the Russian card catalog in the Lenin Library, and got into contact with him. And he told me about an interest he had in British intellectuals and their perceptions of China. And at that point, I was in the Comintern archives. I'd been looking at some things. I was really interested in the rise of communism in China, the rise of nationalism in the 1920s, and the anti-imperialist movement. And the British at that time were the main main target of the anti-imperialist movement. And so I thought that that'd be a great opportunity. I could study in London. And actually, it was a really great topic to do in London because I lived literally a 10-minute walk from the British Library, so I had access to all kinds of personal papers. I was close to, well, just a tube ride to Kew Gardens, which is where the National Archives are. So that's where all the government papers are. So there were tons of Foreign Office documents that I could look at. I was also a 15-minute walk from the School of Oriental and African Studies, SOAS, which has the largest and best missionary archives and all kinds of papers from people who are interested in China. So it was a really great topic. I could also, you know, have easy train travel from London to all kinds of places throughout the UK. I went to Oxford, Cambridge, Manchester, Birmingham. So it was a great opportunity to kind of explore the rich archives in Britain.
Yeah, and that does get to one of the key themes of your book, which is it's the role that British perceptions of China are playing in terms of shaping policy. And as you point out, those perceptions are usually not terribly accurate, but you really link the different perceptions with sometimes how they shaped or oftentimes simply rationalized the policy decisions they had to make.
Yeah, exactly. So, being the children of immigrants and then immigrating here to the UK, I was really interested in cultural perceptions and international history, international relations. So the focus of my book, it's based on my dissertation, which was actually quite narrowly focused on 1925 to 1927, which are the most important years for Britain's retreat from China. But I was interested in looking at British policymaking in this period from the perspective of cultural perceptions. So, you know, because my main argument is that policymakers don't operate within a vacuum. And they're not always just making policy kind of, you know, based just on financial interests, which is an argument that a lot of imperial historians make. But rather, the broader context is really important to take account of cultural assumptions, perceptions. So I wanted to bring in the historical field has kind of developed. There's been a lot of interest in social history, cultural history, and I thought that it's kind of time for political history to move on a bit with the times.
Mm-hmm. You begin your book in 1900. Why is that particular year so important?
Yeah, it's somewhat curious because I think anybody who's a specialist in this topic would think, okay, Britain's imperial retreat from China. Wait, hold on, this is 1900. This is during the Boxer Rebellion. The British are actually taking quite a lot from China and almost seem to be continuing their informal imperialism in China. But I did this because I wanted to take a broader view because if the narratives about China were important, I had to take a longer view. And 1900 was important because of the Boxer Crisis and because of the questions about whether or not China was awakening and whether or not the Boxer Crisis and subsequent manifestations, you know, of anti-imperial protests were evidence of a true Chinese nationalism and how seriously Britain needed to take that challenge and whether or not Britain should accede to the challenges of Chinese nationalism. And so there are all kinds of debates that rise up about the nature of Chinese awakening from 1900 onwards.
But you don't start just with 1900 in that respect. You actually begin the book by looking at, by summarizing sort of those pre 1900 assumptions about China that the British held. You talk about this issue of Chinese awakening. I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit about that in the context of those perceptions. I mean, was there just one commonly held view about China, or were there different, shall we say, schools of thinking about China?
Yeah, okay, yeah, exactly. That's a good question. So, you know, the idea of Orientalism, you know, has been, was really important kind of in history. But the kind of problem is that I think the views are sometimes a bit simplistic, you know, and the idea that Western perceptions of the East have always been negative and have always just kind of supported you know, imperial violence against the East. But what I seek to show is that actually there are Western perceptions of China are completely biased, and they kind of come from nowhere in some cases. But they aren't always kind of a self-affirming discourse. British views of China, the earliest English accounts of China were based on Spanish and Portuguese works, especially by Catholic missionaries, the Jesuits who had gone to China. And
just to be clear, you're reaching back as far as the 16th and 17th centuries in terms of when the English and then the British begin this distant but direct encounter with China.
Right, exactly. And a lot of the emphasis on these works were, you know, on China as a ancient civilization with this remarkable pedigree of achievements and cultured philosophy. But kind of on the negative side, the flip side was that its ancientness and its attainments had made the Chinese really arrogant and xenophobic. And in the 17th and 18th century, as trade contacts continue, there's a rage for Chinese things. And there's even influence in literature and theater and that's called and that's the kind of popularization of chinoiserie. So it's a style that is really popular among the elite throughout all of Europe. So for example, if you go to Kew Gardens, which is the Royal Botanic Gardens in London, you can still see a Chinese pagoda today, because the garden designer installed a Chinese pagoda. It was all part of, you know, what was trendy at that time. But it's commonly understood that by the 19th century, attitudes towards China were somewhat changing, that as the British Empire kind of grew in confidence, as the Industrial Revolution progressed and as they began to make gains in empire, China's kind of ancient civilization that had been widely admired was increasingly condemned for its incurable conservatism, and people began to prescribe the need for the West as a progressive modern force to open up China. And that's kind of in broad brushstrokes, but at the same time, even while people are using these tropes about China to justify, you know, the outbreak of the First Opium War, the need to open China up for free trade, to open up, you know, the kind of sleeping Chinese. Even at the same time, there are also British who are really uncomfortable with the imperial endeavors, and they actually take the kind of same tropes to justify themselves. So for example, the idea of China as a sleeping giant in a narcotic stupor kind of induced by opium is taken by those who are anti-opium. There's a really big anti-opium movement, a big opposition to the Opium War in Britain. And and that kind of picture of China is taken as a justification to advocate a more sympathetic attitude towards China.
And it seems like there's a certain amount of guilt implicit or explicit in that, given that it's the British that are injecting so much opium into China as a result of their desire for a favorable trade balance.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, and the people who supported the Opium War justified, they said, oh, this isn't about opium. It's about free trade. It's about enabling the Chinese to participate in the riches, you know, of the entire world. Free, you know, but it's really interesting is because, is that morality really plays into empire. It, on the one hand, it justifies empire. So in the case of the missionaries who are able to proselytize in China because of the gains from the unequal treaty signed in the 19th century, on the one hand, they gain from, but on the other hand, because their mission is predicated kind of on a moral basis, they're always uncomfortable with the way in which empire was begun and the way that it continues. And that's always eating away at the confidence of, I think, the British Imperial Project.
So when you get to 1900, while you still have, as you mentioned, the British Empire at high tide, you have the British as, you know, one of the participants in the suppression of the Boxer Rebellion. They benefit from the indemnity and settlement of the Boxer Rebellion. But there is still this undercurrent of concern, doubt, guilt that, as you describe, comes to the surface fairly soon afterward. It doesn't wait till the 1920s. As you describe, it comes about in 1905, 1906, 1907, and begins to exert an influence upon British policy from that point onward.
So one of the people that I focus on in the chapter on 1900 to 1910 is Sir Robert Hart. And Sir Robert Hart has been the subject of a number of books by really famous Chinese historians. So John King Fairbank, you know, for example, and more recently, Robert Bickers and Hans van de Ven. And he's an extremely important, influential figure in Sino-British relations because he's the inspector general of the Chinese maritime customs. So he's actually, so the maritime customs collected revenue from the customs for the Chinese government, really to pay off the indemnities and, you know, all the money that was owed to the Western powers. And a British sir was always kind of in charge of it, although they were employees of the Chinese government. But he's a really important figure. And right after the Boxer crisis, he wrote a book called These from the Land of Sinim. And Sinim, that title was a reference actually to the Bible, to Isaiah chapter 49, a verse in that chapter. And in it, and in that book, Hart is already arguing for the need for the British to begin thinking about renouncing the unequal treaties, to abolish the trappings of informal empire, to get rid of the unequal tariffs, to think about getting rid of extraterritoriality. And the reason why he's saying this is because he says that we cannot have a kind of hypocritical stance towards the Chinese. As a Christian nation, we need to treat the Chinese in a moral way. It's not very well received, but the fact that somebody with such a high position and somebody who is kind of at the forefront of Sino-British relations espouses these views, I think, is really an interesting thing. Mm-hmm. One thing that he uses, and I think this is really interesting in terms of the stereotypes and perceptions of the Chinese, is the idea of the yellow peril. This is an idea that was originated in the, you know, in ancient times in the Greco-Persian Wars, but later on East Asians were incorporated into the idea of the yellow peril. And it's this idea that, you know, the masses of primitive, brutal savages who have powers of the occult were going to, pose a huge threat and danger to the Western world, that that if kind of led by the right powers, that they would be brought into this apocalyptic final battle with the West. And it was popularized by the Kaiser in Germany in the 1890s, and then later on with the Fu Manchu books in England. But the really interesting thing is that Sir Robert Hart buys into this idea. He does kind of believe in the yellow peril, and a lot of commentators who advocate for a more positive policy towards China talk about the need for a more conciliatory policy towards the Chinese because of the fear that the Chinese masses, in all their hundreds of millions, would rise up against the West, and so it was necessary to kind of placate them.
And that gets back to the common foundation of these differing views that you do reference, is that mm-hmm. while you do have these contrasts, they still are based on what really comes across as a striking distance. They do have people like Robert Hart, like G.E. Morrison, who have a degree of familiarity with, direct familiarity with China. But oftentimes the discourse is happening among all these people, foreign secretaries, permanent ministers in parliament, in the press, who have never seen China, who've never gotten within 1,000 miles of China. And yet they're making these decisions that are rooted in something. And they're rooted in this sense of China's alienness. Should it be dominated? Should it be placated?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It's interesting you bring up G.E. Morrison, because G.E. Morrison was the Times correspondent, the Times China correspondent based in Beijing. And as such, he was really influential. He hobnobbed with all the important people in Whitehall. He would have conversations with the foreign secretary, Sir Edward Grey. He also talked to the Secretary of State for India, John Morley. And around this period as well, after the Russo-Japanese War, Morrison, who had always been a real kind of supporter of the Japanese, really changes his tune and becomes an advocate for Chinese nationalism after the Japanese win the war against Russia, and are in the ascendance in influence in China. Morrison resents that, and he begins to argue that the British need to kind of ally with the Chinese. And he has an ear with the people kind of in the highest echelons of power in London. So he comes back to London and he has all these conversations, and he's pushing for this kind of view, a view that is sympathetic to Chinese nationalism.
And this is coming about at the same time as the Liberals win the election in 1906. They introduce measures to put an end to the opium trade. So there is a real shift taking place in British policy that predates the 1920s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So in 1906, Parliament finally, votes to end the British involvement in the opium trade. And the anti-opium movement has had a long genealogy, really, from the 1830s. And what I sought to find from the archives, what I found was that Parliament and the government, they weren't just kind of operating in this vacuum, but all kinds of people were calling for the end of the opium trade. There were resolutions from, Deptford Women's Association, a group of Anglican bishops in China, all kinds of, New Zealand Council of Christian Churches. They were all sending in resolutions, excoriating the immorality of the opium trade and pressing the government to end it.
So, but of course, this isn't all happening in a vacuum, because China is itself undergoing a lot of internally driven changes, most dramatically with the ending of the imperial government in 1911. Mm-hmm. And how does that play into the perceptions and the advocacy of policies in Britain towards China?
Yeah. Right. So the revolution is really a watershed in the sense that it establishes the first republic ever in Asia, and it ends thousands of years of monarchical rule. It's really interesting, because the debate among historians today about whether or not, it is this true watershed, whether 1911 constitutes China's entrance into modernity, it kind of mirrors debates that were going on at the time. And especially in the British government, about how seriously 1911 should be taken. Were the Republicans, were they truly modern, modern leaders who were patriotic and had the kind of the nation's best interests in their heart, or were they kind of the typical traditional corrupt venal bureaucrats that that, you know, that, that the stereotype that the British had always kind of bought into. And so this gives the occasion for all kinds of debates about the nature of the revolution. And so G. Morrison is really active in this debate. He actually eventually is so positive about the Republic that he signs on to a lucrative job. He becomes the advisor to Yuan Shikai government in China. He drops his job as the Times correspondent. But there's this huge debate between him and the Shanghai correspondent, J.O.P. Bland, who is a really interesting character. He's this kind of acerbic, cantankerous kind of person. And he's very pessimistic about the Chinese Republic and about China. And so, yeah, and it's really interesting how he's just lambasting, the talk of uplift and kind of moral lobby.
One of the things I like that you do at this point is how you tie it into the earlier metaphors that you describe in the book about, you know, China being the sleeping giant, dulled by opium, and how the 1911 revolution becomes sort of they frame it in that context. Is China awakening up? Is this the point at which the slumbering giant now is beginning to stir? And how they are encountering this new event, and they immediately revert back to the traditional modes of thinking, the traditional paradigms, to try to process it.
Exactly. I mean, those kinds of issues are, and also, you know, what's happening, you know, from 1911 onwards, the thing is that they're having these debates, but then immediately they're kind of plunged into the First World War. Mm-hmm. And so there really isn't that much chance there isn't that much opportunity to give young China a chance at this point. But what's important is that these ideas are there, and that they're kind of being debated. And what's also important is the Americans really kind of come on the scene in this period. So the U.S. The U.S. really becomes a major player in Asia after the First World War. But already the Americans are very supportive of the 1911 revolution. Yuan Shikai sends he asks, you know, Christians all over the world to pray for China. And this is a huge public relations boon for him in the U.S. You know, all the Americans think that this is a great gesture, and that China, you know, this great ancient country, you know, might be able to kind of be formed, you know, in the image of the West, you know, of a progressive Christian kind of civilization. And so a lot of Americans are really excited about the awakening of China, more so than in England. But the increasing American influence, you know, over British policy is important, because this is all kind of backing American policy.
You mentioned the First World War, and it has a, you know, major role in modern historical thinking about about its impact upon the development and ultimately the decline of the British Empire. How does it affect Britain's relations with China in the second decade of the 20th century? And how does it fit within this ongoing debate about China and whether it is awakening or whether it's sort of a false dawn and China is still very much of a basket case?
Okay. Well, there's a lot. I think we can't underestimate how much Britain was affected by the First World War, and we can't understand, you know, British policy towards China without taking into account the overall context. And this is actually where, when I wrote my dissertation, this is where I kind of began the dissertation, because I thought it was such an important point. So a few things, you know, after the First World War. So economically, Britain had lost its economic dominance in the world and in East Asia, because they had been distracted. Other, you know, more competition. So the Japanese, even India, China, they all benefited from the vacuum that the British left. So they lost their dominance. But this also tied into the problem of massive unemployment after the First World War. Unemployment was at 10% in 1920, and it remained high throughout the entire interwar period. And so it was really necessary to arrive at a solution to the problems, to the economic problems. And China was always seen, it was kind of this platitude that China would be a panacea to all of Britain's economic ills. With a market of 400 million. I mean, even today, this is, you know, a major issue, you know, in the idea that, you know, if the Chinese market would just open up to the West, that would take care of all of our problems because of this huge population. And so policymakers are really keen to find a way to keep trade going, to increase trade with China, to cultivate good relations with China. But more broadly, after the First World War, obviously attitudes towards the use of force radically changed. Disarmament was a major aim. Pacifism gained in popularity. People joined all kinds of internationalist movements, you know, supporting the League of Nations. And so when challenges came to the British interests in China, the British public was not ready to go to war. They were not ready to use force against China. And that was always kind of in the back of the policymaker's mind. And then, you know, one other important point that I wanted to bring out was that what happened in China, the retreat that happened in China, didn't happen kind of on its own. China was not a special case. Generally, we always think that decolonization for Britain happens after 1945. But actually in the interwar period, if we talk about informal empire, the British were kind of relinquishing quite a lot of gains. So, for example, in Turkey and Egypt and Persia and Siam, and in Persia and in Siam, they renounce extraterritoriality by the end of the 1920s. The Turks also win independence and they abolished extraterritoriality in 1923. So this is part of a larger trend of things that are going on after the First World War.
You're also seeing another dimension that that plays a growing role in British attitudes towards China, which is the challenge of Bolshevism, the perception of the spread of communism. And in the latter chapters of your book, that is a perennial filter through which so many people in Britain see what's going on in China. That's the metric. Is this going to aid Bolshevism? Is this a response to Bolshevism? And that shapes how they not only perceive it, but how they decide whether they're going to support it or oppose it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what kind of adds to the urgency of the necessity of arriving at a solution to the British position in China. Again, I think this kind of comes from that yellow peril idea again, and actually quite overtly, J.L. Garvin, the editor of The Observer, he was also very influential in the elite circles, and he was in correspondence with Austen Chamberlain, the foreign secretary, but he uses that trope of the yellow peril, and as do a lot of MPs in the parliamentary debates. They see the Chinese as kind of childlike, unable to almost kind of think for themselves, but they're violent masses that are easily led, you know, by another force. And so they see the Bolshevik threat as, you know, the Soviets kind of manipulating the Chinese masses against the West. And so it's really important to consider then, well, how can the British government appease the Chinese and, you know, take take the mantle of leadership away from the Soviets and kind of get the Chinese to be friendly with them instead.
And this brings us to 1925 and the events that happened in May and how you see that as a real pivot point. I was wondering if you could explain what happened then and why does it really accelerate or change a lot of these developments that you've been talking about?
Yeah. Okay. So May 30th, specifically 1925 is really important. So at this point, the Kuomintang and the CCP, so the Chinese Nationalists and the Chinese Communist Party, they're all kind of gaining in strength and they're going around organizing workers into pro-Chinese and anti-imperial movements in important cities. And Shanghai is the kind of jewel in Britain's informal empire in China. Shanghai is the most important city. Shanghai's workers were kind of being organized into these anti-imperial movements. And there were a bunch of conflicts and strikes that escalated in 1925. At first, they were targeted at the Japanese because there were strikes at the Japanese-run cotton mills. But at one of them, a Chinese protester was shot dead. And in the aftermath of his death, the protests became bigger and bigger. And And they eventually, the protests kind of reached the international settlement. A bunch of students were arrested and brought into a police station along the Nanjing Road in the international settlement. And when they were arrested, the crowds kind of came demanding for their release. So thousands of people, were around this police station. And the British inspector in charge, actually, the British inspector in charge was actually off at the race course watching some horse racing. So he wasn't that bothered. But the second in charge actually ordered the troops. So they were Sikh and Chinese policemen, ordered them to shoot at the crowd. And so several died and many were wounded. And this sparked a series of strikes and boycotts all over the country that were targeted specifically at the British. This was a huge anti-British movement. And there was a boycott in Hong Kong that really affected British trade. And so this was a direct attack on the British position in China.
It really is an interesting one, too, on two levels. One, as I was reading, I was thinking about the context. This is 6 years after the Amritsar massacre in India, which was different in the sense that that was an area where Britain had direct control, and yet even there it was enormously controversial. And by doing the strikes and the boycotts, you're creating a situation where you're attacking the very reason why Britain is there, and you're doing so in an environment where, unlike in India, the British have far less ability to directly go in and deal with this. So you're striking at the very reason for their existence, and it's kind of underscoring, is it really worthwhile to be here if we can't really get what we want, if we're even less constrained? Is it perhaps time to cut our losses?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So on the one hand, the economic troubles at home, and then the kind of nature of attacking economic interests in this movement, they kind of come together, forcing the British government to really press for a solution. They need to find a solution so that trade can be resumed once again. But on the other hand, they're constrained because the domestic environment, there's public support for disarmament and peace, and a real resistance to using force to enforce British claims in China. But you also have all these kinds of things are inflaming the business lobby, the China Association in Britain, and they're constantly at the Foreign Office and asking the Foreign Office to do something, but the Foreign Office is always kind of repelling them and saying, sorry, our hands are tied, we can't do anything, and so the business lobby is really quite angry at this point.
It's also, at this point, getting wrapped up into the growing opposition that you're seeing on the right towards this criticism of empire, this signals of withdrawal from the empire. And you spent a lot of time talking about this right-wing opposition from people like Leo Maxey and the National Review and how they're arguing for the whole, fire another round. We need to teach them what's what, and how that is very much how policy is having to go very much against that tide.
Yeah, which is interesting because the government in charge is conservative, and what's really interesting and what I brought out in this book, what I feel hasn't really been brought out that much is, at the same time of these right-wing protests, there's also there's a lot of left-wing interest in what's going on in China. And so 1925 is also the year where there begins to be a hands-off China movement. And this gains kind of nationwide support. By 1927, there are nationwide protests all around the country just supporting the Chinese and kind of pressuring the government. The government, I don't think, necessarily listens directly, to what labor is saying. They think they're a bit too radical, but they're not unaware that there is this kind of strong feeling about what's going on in China.
I should make it clear that when you talk about labor, you're talking specifically about the Labor Party, labor movement in general. Yes.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
That's one of the interesting parts about that, which is how you're seeing within Parliament the expression of that, how there is a movement in a party which is much more overtly critical of imperialism than even the Liberals had been, whereas Liberals were going after, narrowly speaking, the opium trade from a moral standpoint, from a religious standpoint. The labor movement is much more willing to embrace themes of anti-imperialism. We're talking about people like George Lansbury, who goes on to Youth Labor Party in the 1930s. They're willing to form organizations that are about criticizing British policy in China and arguing for what you describe as imperial retreat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And but there's also an intersection, you know, between kind of a moral stance and anti-imperialism. And George Lansbury, who you brought up, is a really good example of that. He was a Christian socialist and famous for his feminism, but his kind of Christianity also played into it. And what's really interesting is how much Christian organizations are activated by what's happening in China. So the YWCA, the National Christian Council, even the establishment of the Institute of Pacific Relations, the IPR, it's established in July 1925, and even today it's an important kind of think tank. But its establishment, a lot of the people involved in it were related to the YMCA. 22% were kind of directly related. About 90% saw themselves as classed themselves as Christians, and a lot of their recommendations towards China were based on precepts of kind of Christian morality, of not being hypocritical towards China. And so it's really interesting how all these things kind of come together.
So then, how does policy change in the aftermath of these protests and these boycotts?
So some of these people, they have a way, you know, they have, they speak to the Foreign Office, they speak to the government. So some of the most trusted advisors are Henry Hodgkin, Henry Hodgkin or Sir Charles Addis. So Henry Hodgkin was the secretary of the National Christian Council. Sir Charles Addis, which is really interesting, was a chairman of the Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation, HSBC. So he kind of represented financial interests, but at the same time, he was a very kind of devout person and very much, you know, the way he talked about China, he kind of conflated it with kind of missionary impulse as well. But they're talking to Sir Austen Chamberlain, they're talking to members in the Far Eastern Department who are responsible for making policy, and they're listening to them. And so by 1926, you know, as the Kuomintang, the Nationalist Party, is making its military gains through the Northern Expedition, as they're making their way up China, and looking like a real viable government in China, because prior to this point, China had been thrown into a period of civil war, chaos. There's a lot of fighting between warlords after the death of Yuan Zhikai. But the Kuomintang seems to be gaining strength. And so the government is beginning to assess, okay, is this a true manifestation of nationalism? How should we treat it? And by the end of 1926, they decide that that the government needs to make a kind of firm declaration that they are willing to accede to the demands of Chinese nationalism and begin the process of giving China back its tariff autonomy. And that's significant because that's one of the first things signed away in the unequal treaties. So giving back this aspect of Chinese sovereignty. So the British write this. So the Foreign Office puts out this memorandum in December, and it's also called the Christmas Memorandum. It's showing their goodwill towards the Chinese.
Another aspect of the Kuomintang support that the British were beginning to consider is the fact that that was also around the time that the Kuomintang is not just militarily going after the Chinese Communist Party, but they've also, in the process of doing so, they've cleaved themselves away from communism. In the early 1920s, you described there was that flirtation, that involvement, that led a lot of people on the right to say, well, maybe we can't trust the Kuomintang. But now that they've done that, they seem like a much safer bet for entrusting, in a sense, or backing in terms of maintaining some degree of British interest in China.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So Chiang Kai-shek, he calls for he launches the White Terror in Shanghai in 1927, the 12th of April 1927. Basically, this is a massive purge of the communists in the party. And at this point, he's kind of in a state of, you know, civil war with the left wing of the Kuomintang. So there's a left wing, there's another government in Wuhan. But gradually, Chiang Kai-shek is becoming kind of ascendant. He's consolidating his power. And they realize, okay, he's not going to be a puppet of the communists anymore. On the one hand, this kind of dampens down the enthusiasm that the left wing, labor, and the communists had for the nationalist movement. The hands-off China movement kind of ends around 1927, kind of fades away. But the right wing is also somewhat appeased and not so vociferously opposed then to the British government's overtures, you know, of kind of conciliation with the Chinese.
There's one final aspect that you mentioned near the end of the book, which is one of the consequences of all of these dramatic events is that it's, along with broader changes that are taking place globally, is that the profits that business interests are getting from China are down. And I wonder if there was some sort of if that contributed as well, the sense that that the British could not make as much money in China with these methods, that maybe they should not be as committed to such a direct and frankly expensive involvement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so it's interesting. Yeah. So economic interests obviously suffer. But economic interests don't improve when they change their policy. And that's part of my argument that the British actually did retreat in China, because there is a school of historians, especially economic historians, who argue that actually the British never retreated from China in the interwar period, that these different tactics were just ways to further financial interests. But it never really kind of plays. It never really plays out. The British keep losing money, and so the really interesting thing is then, you know, what ultimately motivates policy? Is it just finances? Is it just money? You know, all the time, or do people's assumptions, you know, about the other moral considerations, ideology, all of these other aspects play into the story of empire as well.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time. Before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Yeah, sure. So I've looked at the end of British Empire, retreat of British Empire. So what I'm thinking about doing, and what I've kind of started on, is to look at the beginning of the British Empire in China. And once again, I want to connect the political decisions towards China with the intellectual environment. So broadly speaking, people have seen, okay, that there's a shift from Sinophilia, so the rage for Chinoiserie in the 18th century, to this marked shift, you know, Sinophobia after the failure of the Macartney mission trying to open trade with China. After that failed, then what's commonly understood is that the British then, you know, begin to speak about how arrogant and how hopeless China is, how decrepit it is, and how it's necessary for the British to come in and help to modernize China. But if you get into there's been a lot of literary studies on, you know, British views of China in this period, and what comes across is that the discourse is not that unified. And that the knowledge about China was manipulated to serve all kinds of purposes. And also in terms of the origins of the Opium War, a lot of new books have shown that actually the Opium War, there's a lot of contingency, a lot of chaos, you know, things that happen a few days before the outbreak contribute to the outbreak. So I think this story is a lot more complex. It's not just in the attitude necessarily, the attitudes change, I think, and then there's war. So there's a lot, I think, to bring out, a lot of space for scholarly research.
Well, it sounds like a great project, and I hope we can have you back once you publish it.
Yeah, sure.
Phoebe Chow, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us today. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much.